hotline to bring in our very next guest. We've got Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram and a special contributor to Forbes. Jim, as always, we appreciate the time. You wrote an article over the weekend detailing a wide range of Cleveland sports topics, and I want to begin with the Cleveland Cavaliers, who are in a bit of a bind right now, really not playing great basketball. They've lost seven in a row, but you detailed in your article over the weekend that you believe this is the right time to trade Tristan Thompson. Why do you believe now is the right time to trade him away?
Well, I just think that, you know, given where the Cavs are and their kind of rebuilding project here, and given where Tristan is, not just in his contract, but with his playing career, I would think, even though he's in the last year of his contract, that there's a playoff team that out there. I don't know who it would be right now, but I would like to believe that there'd be one out there that could use a guy like him who's, you know, we've all seen him contribute to a championship team in 2016 with the Cavs. And, you know, he's one of those rare NBA players that's pretty much totally unselfish and is not only willing but eager to do the dirty work inside, you know, going for rebounds and getting teams extra possessions and taking a charge and, you know, just kind of doing the grunt work that every championship team needs. And I, you know, from the Cavs standpoint, they're clearly not going anywhere this year. And if they could get a, you know, even from a good team, if they could get a first-round pick, even though it might be lower down than the lottery, would still be worth considering, I believe.
You also threw out the name Kevin Love, and I think we've been hearing a lot about these trade rumors almost since the day he arrived back in 2014. But, you know, do you think it's realistic that they could deal him at this point, given that he's 31 years old, his injury history in recent years, and the fact that he makes a lot of money and he's still owed a lot of money over the next 3 years?
Yeah, he's a little bit more of a complex situation there. You're right about, you know, a lot of money for a player that frequently gets injured. On the other hand, he's a player that frequently scores a lot of points and gets a lot of rebounds. So you got to kind of balance that from the Cavs' point of view and also for a potential trade partner's point of view. You know, I would think, you know, the fact that he's got three more years left on his contract would make him attractive to a team that has enough assets that, you know, if they did get him and he got injured, it wouldn't, you know, completely sabotage their season. But I don't know. He's, you know, the thing he had earlier this year where he was kind of pouting the way some of the younger players were playing, that's not a good look. And he's kind of had an uneven stay in Cleveland here. And but, you know, there aren't many guys that can average double figures in rebounds and points per game. So he would be another one that would be a candidate, not in my mind as good as Thompson. I do think that, and I can't tell you the particulars of this, but I'm pretty sure that if they wait until the off season, his value might go up a little more given his contract situation. So maybe that's one that comes later, but it wouldn't shock me if he were traded, or even if both him and Thompson were traded for that matter, you know, at the trade deadline in February.
Yeah, we're not that far away from it. As a matter of fact, just about a week and a half away from that NBA trading deadline. Jim, let's transition into some baseball talk. I want to hit on something here that you mentioned on Saturday. Well, you said the best part about being a baseball Hall of Fame voter is that nothing that you and that collective group, the voting members of the Baseball Writers Association of America, do every year draws more rabid interest than the Baseball Hall of Fame vote. You went on to state that it gives you a lot of confidence moving forward to know that the game still has a great deal of popularity, especially when you relate that conversation to the Hall of Fame conversations of the other sports. Jim, I thought that was fascinating. I just kind of wanted to give you a chance to expand on that.
Yeah, I you know, as popular as football is and basketball too, but I mean football is kind of looked at, I think, now generally speaking, as the number one sport in this country. But I don't know, and I've been voting in the Hall of Fame elections for I think 20 years now, and every year the voting on that thing gets just more and more intense, not just by the voters, but, you know, the fans who really pay attention to who you vote for. I mean, they almost demand that you reveal your vote. We're not supposed to do that before the elections are announced, which I never do, but I revealed who I voted for right after the vote this year. And then if you want to go on the Baseball Writers Association of America website, you can I think they put it on there 2 weeks after the vote. They put everyone that voted in it and who they voted for. But there's this kind of rabid enthusiasm for critiquing every single vote. And for a long time, it's getting almost to the point now where sometimes the criticism gets almost like personal. Like it's like, I think it's been exacerbated by the rise of analytics and that whole dynamic with the old school, new school way of evaluating players. But you know, the bottom line to me is there is this intense interest in the Baseball Hall of Fame and who gets voted in and who isn't getting voted in and how much did they miss by or how much did they make it by. I mean, you know, this year, for example, Jeter got all the votes but one, and it was almost like people were like insulted by that. I mean, it was clearly a terrible, in my opinion, judgment not to vote for Jeter. I mean, when you're the only one out of over 300 people that didn't vote for the guy, I think you got to really question that. But the fans really, really do get, you know, into these voting things, and for about 2 weeks before and 2 weeks or 3 weeks after, you know, the analyzing of who voted for who and why they did that, and you know, why you didn't vote for more guys, why you voted for that many guys. There's just all kinds of angles to it, and I think the rabidness with which fans follow the Hall of Fame voting is a good indicator that while maybe baseball's in a little bit of a down cycle right now, there still is a core interest in there in the fabric and culture of our country.
Again, we're being joined by Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram and a special contributor to Forbes. Jim, to stay with that topic for another moment, you mentioned that you've been a part of that collective group now for over 20 years. Does it get tougher every year when you take a look at those names on the ballot? I'm talking about the guys that are heavily linked in to the steroid era, the Clemenses, the Bonds of the world. Does it get tougher to vote on those guys every single year, or in your mind, is that a pretty simple decision?
Well, specifically on those guys, the steroid guys, I've never voted for them, and I never will vote for them. So that eliminates, and it kind of varies from year to year how many of those kinds of guys are on the ballot. I mean, the big ones now obviously are Clemens and Bonds, but I have never voted for either of those guys because I just think it's, you know, it really annoys me, for example, when I look in the record books and I see Barry Bonds, like, all over the home runs and the on-base percentage and the walks. And the steroid guys, in my opinion, just distorted the game's history by doing what they did. And, you know, the argument against that gets thrown in the faces of people with my opinion is that, well, you don't know for sure that they did it. Well, no, we don't, but blame the players for that quandary that they've put the voting process and not the voters. We've got to sort it out on our own, and you know, some of us do it one way and some of us do it another way, and I just think that you know, those kinds of guys aren't going to get my vote. So you know, this year there were those two guys, Bonds and Clemens, which I eliminated. This was actually a year when I voted for only four guys, and I think that's the lowest I've ever voted since I've been doing this. And I voted for Jeter, I voted for Schilling and Omar, and the other one was Larry Walker. So I voted for those four. And some years they're a lot harder to make the calls on, and other years they're not so hard. You're allowed to vote for 10. Like I said, I voted for only four this year. I usually average probably about five or six, maybe. I really place a high. That's the other thing that the fans must realize. Most of the writers I know that vote in Hall of Fame voting, they don't take this lightly. I mean, they really sit down and study it. Like in my case, I mean, it usually takes me a day or two, almost the entire day or two, to go over it and really make my mind up, because you know, this is a decision that changes people's lives, you know, guys that get voted in and guys that don't. So I and all the guys that I know that are writers in the process, they take that very seriously. So it's a really a privilege, as I said, and it's one of the things I look most forward to. But with all the shrapnel flying around the voters at that time of year, it's almost one that I dread a little bit, because sometimes the criticism gets over the top. But I'm encouraged by the fact, as I said, that the Baseball Hall of Fame voting is miles ahead of the other major sports when it comes to interest nationally, I believe, in the Hall of Fame voting.
I want to stay on that topic as it pertains to Omar Vizquel. Jim, how encouraging was this last round of voting for Omar, and about how many years away do you think he is from getting in?
I thought it was very encouraging. He jumped another 10% up to 52%, and that's just his third year on the ballot now. Players that have been on that kind of a track their first 3 years, almost all of them have eventually made it to the Hall of Fame, and I'm very encouraged that Omar eventually will. He's fighting an uphill battle, though, because the analytics people just not only don't think he belongs in the Hall of Fame, they don't even think he belongs in the discussion, which, as someone who saw virtually every game Omar played in his prime, which was all with the Indians, I've never had a lot of faith in defensive metrics to begin with, because I just think there's too many instances where I've seen, well, this one's the prime example, where my argument would be, if you brought someone to an Indians game and never seen a baseball game before in their life, in one game they would probably be able to realize and acknowledge that Omar was like the best player on the field defensively. And I just think he made so many plays that year in, year out, and he played shortstop as a major league regular for virtually all 24 years in the big leagues, which by itself, I think, is an undervalued trait for players, the longevity in the big leagues to be able to fight off all the challenges you get from younger players who come into the game every year, and then to excel at a premier position like Omar did for nearly a quarter of a century, and he basically reinvented the position defensively in his time of his career. To me, it's always been a no-brainer for him, but I do think he's getting closer. I think it might take another year or two, probably closer to two than one, but I do think he's trending in the right direction, and hopefully he'll eventually make it. Because another thing is, you know, you can't quantify this, but just the joy he played with and the joy that he gave fans and the thrills and the excitement. I mean, there's something to be said for that, I think, that could be in the equation as well.
Well, yeah, and I was just going to go down that road, Jim. I mean, I think in today's day and age, that means a lot. I mean, you know, the human element has to be a part of this, doesn't it? And I mean, you could take a look at Barry Bonds' career up and down, and you take a look at his numbers, and you think, sure, absolutely, but then you factor in the steroid discussion, and then you factor in the idea that, boy, outside of a couple of, you know, beat writers and radio announcers, and maybe to some degree television personalities as well in the Bay Area, not many people like Barry Bonds. And I would like to think that the human element, that comes into play at some point, doesn't it?
Yeah, in fact, in the Hall of Fame, the instructions we get every year from the Hall of Fame for voting, part of it is brings up the subject of character. You know, how you judge a player's character, and to me, character means, you know, were fans drawn to you? Did they like? Did you have the charisma that draw fans to you? You know, did you play the game fairly, and did you do the things that drew more fans to the park? You weren't a guy that was always in trouble, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And to me, Omar checks every one of those boxes. I mean, he's about as feel-good a player as you could imagine, as everyone in Cleveland already knows, because we saw him play. And I just think that the combination of that, and, you know, the one thing that the analytics people kind of scoff at is most of his high rankings in the statistical categories are counting stats, which are like, you know, hits and stolen bases and stuff like that, where it's not like a percentage of stuff. And, you know, but to me, to be able to stick around long enough to almost get 3,000 hits, which almost automatically puts you in the Hall of Fame, I think Omar fell about 150 short. That's a major feat in itself. And so I just think, Yeah, to answer your question, the character thing is a big factor, and I think it's a major one why Bonds isn't in there, along with the steroid situation. And even Clemens, he was a little bit easier going than Bonds, but still was really no day at the beach, I don't think, when it came to the media. So it all factors into it, and each of the voters have to, you know, parse it the way how much value they want to give to each of these little areas, and then you go with your best gut and make your votes.
Two more questions for you, Jim. One pertains to the present-day tribe. The other goes back to the glory days, the Indians of the 90s. We'll stick with the current tribe situation for now. Yasiel Puig still unsigned, and we are just a couple of weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting in Goodyear. You hearing anything about Yasiel Puig? What would you say the chances are the Indians make a move and put him back out in right field? It just seems like we're getting awfully close to crunch time, and the Indians have a lot of questions in the outfield.
I didn't think there was a chance at all when the offseason began that he would be back here, but I did think in the back of my mind, if this thing gets to the start of spring training and he still hasn't signed with anybody and they could get him at a good price for like 1 year, I don't know, 7-8 million, something like that, they might take a shot at it, because, you know, we all know that how weak the Indians are offensively in the outfield, and you know, then it would give you, you know, you could put their plan is to try to get Franmil Reyes to play right field every day, and that, which may or may not work, but if you had Puig out there, you could put Reyes at DH, which he's probably best suited for. But Puig's an interesting guy. I mean, he's got all the peripheral stuff with him, you know, that kind of distract, you know, the team and the fans and the media, really, and how much of that you want to put up with. But I think there's enough upside offensively there that I wouldn't have given him a multi-year deal, but, you know, if he doesn't sign with somebody in the next week, if I was the Indians, it wouldn't surprise me if they have maybe a standing offer to him, that if you don't sign with anybody, here's what we can offer you, and if you're interested, let's talk. So it wouldn't. I think it's more likely that they'll sign him now than they were at the beginning of the offseason. Although I don't think it's anything imminent or anything like that, but I wouldn't put him out of the picture. But we'll see. I mean, it's amazing how players' price tags lower the closer the start of spring training gets, and sometimes you can't steal a bargain guy here or there.
Yeah, and it's getting awfully close to crunch time as far as that is concerned. Well, Jim, you're going to be at Tribe Fest this weekend. You and Mike Hargrove will be signing copies of your book. Mike Hargrove.
Actually, Mike won't be there, but I will.
You'll be there. Okay. Well, you know what? That's just as important. Jim's going to be at TriFest this weekend signing copies of his book, Mike Hargrove and the Cleveland Indians, A Baseball Life. It is a sensational book. If you haven't had the chance to pick one up yet, I highly recommend it. And, Jim, I want to focus on a particular portion of this book where you talk about the deal of Carlos Baerga being sent along with Alvaro Espinoza over to the New York Mets, and just how that kind of sent shockwaves through the entire fan base. You wrote some things in that book that were very telling, and I want to focus on one aspect of this. And the Indians knowing at the time what a PR hit it was going to be, trading away a wildly popular personality in Baerga. You talk about in there how the Indians actually kind of gave certain members of the media a little bit of a glimpse that this was coming, didn't they?
Yeah, one of the more shocking moments of my time on the Indians beat, John Hart actually called myself and Sheldon Oker from the Beacon Journal and Paul Hoynes from the Plain Dealer into his office. I think it was a couple days or maybe a few more before they made the Baerga deal, and he just laid it out and said, we're thinking about trading Baerga. How big of a hit do you think this is going to be? And, you know, we all said that you know, it's going to be a big hit because, you know, he's a three or four time All-Star, and he's the most popular player on the team, and he plays with such enthusiasm, and everybody loves him, and it's, you know, you're going to take a big hit here. But you know, the other side of that coin was, and John Hart talked to Charlie Manuel, the hitting coach at the time, and Charlie completely nailed it. He told John that he thought that Carlos was basically done as an elite hitter, and now would be the time to trade him if you're going to trade him. And they went ahead and did it, and Hart did get bashed severely from a PR standpoint. But when you look at Carlos's stats, you ever look at his body of work in the big leagues, you know, the line that's after his last year in Cleveland started his downward plunge. And although he hung around for another 6 or 8 years, I mean, he was never even close to the player he was when he was with Cleveland. So they made the move at the exactly the right time. But I do remember being in his office, Hart's office, that day with the other two writers, and you know, this was like unprecedented for all three of us to have the general manager actually want to know if this was going to be like a tidal wave of protest from the fans or not. But you know, fortunately, from the Indians' point of view, I guess you would say it worked out. You know, Baer didn't go anywhere and win 2 or 3 batting titles or something like that could have really made the trade look bad. So it was the right trade at the right time, and as was reflective of a lot of the things they did back in those days, it worked out in their favor. And even though they didn't get a lot back for Baerga, they moved on and didn't really miss him from the point of the day they traded him.
Sometimes feels like that trade was just yesterday. Crazy how time flies, but many tales like that and several others are available in that book. It is a terrific read. If you're an Indians fan of the glory days back in the 90s, I highly recommend that. You can see Jim if you head on down to TribeFest this weekend. He'll be there signing copies of the book. Jim, as always, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to catching up again soon.
Thank you a lot, Andy. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. Again, that's Jim Ingram with the Chronicle-Telegram and a special contributor to Forbes. Make sure you pick up a copy of that book. It really is good stuff. Mike Hargrove and the Cleveland Indians, A Baseball Life.